Hey everyone, husband here.
And I'm wife. If you've been listening to us, then you know we're all about reading the Bible and reacting to it on our first read-through. Cuss words, crying, laughing, and more.
We're passionate about creating a podcast that takes the sanctity out of the sacred text and simply stating it as we see it.
But we can't do it without your help. We're asking for your support to help us keep this podcast going.
There are two ways you can donate.
Text SACDIS, that's SACDIS, to 533-555 if you're in the U.S. with a one-time donation. Any amount helps.
Or if you'd rather start a sustaining membership, sign up on our Patreon page at patreon.com/sacrilegiousdiscourse. Membership levels start as low as $2 a month.
We are amazed and grateful for our fans that support us now, and you can become one too.
With your support, we can keep Sacrilegious Discourse alive and well for years to come.
So please donate today.
Text SACDIS to 533-555 if you're in the U.S.
Or sign up for our Patreon page at patreon.com/sacrilegiousdiscourse. Welcome to Sacrilegious Discourse.
I'm husband.
And I'm wife.
Together we're reading the Bible for the very first time.
We grew up without religion and wanted to know what all the fuss was about.
Well, what have we learned so far?
That God is a dick. And apparently some people believe in talking donkeys?
We're not trying to pass ourselves off as experts.
Nope, we're just reading the Bible for the first time and giving our first take reaction.
If you'd like to join us in this venture, you might consider starting at episode 1.
Otherwise, jump in wherever you like.
Alright, let's go read the Bible.
Yeah, let's get to it. Husband!
Wife!
Do you know what we're doing today?
Well, it's still Saturday.
It is.
We didn't get this out in the morning, but that means that today is...
Q&A Saturday.
That's right. And what are we Q&A and A-ing today?
We are going over Jeremiah chapter 16 through 20.
All right. Let's do this.
Okie dokie.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
All right, we are going to do a Q&A.
Okay.
Over chapter 16 through 20.
Yeah.
And I'm just going to go through and point out some shit that we missed the first time through.
Sure. And I think we missed some of it on purpose so that we would have a Q&A to go over.
Yes. But there wasn't like any one particular thing that was more than a, and that's the answer to that.
Boom. Right.
So but that's so, why I kind of saved like, them all up.
We'd gotten into a habit lately of maybe covering too much during our weeklies and left us nothing to talk about sometimes on the Q&As.
Sure. So. And I had to find a topic then.
Right. Yeah. So and we've that's been harder. Trying to leave some things for the Q&As.
Sure.
But.
So, all right, starting with chapter 16 of Jeremiah.
Okay.
This chapter was all about the Lord's judgment of the people, okay? And in the first four, what are they called, verses, Jeremiah was commanded to not take a wife or to father any children.
Remember? Right.
Yeah. That was in verse 2. You shall not take a wife, nor shall you have sons or daughters in this fucking place.
That's what Jeremiah told us anyway.
Yeah.
Yep.
So in ancient Jewish culture, which I kind of mentioned this at the time, and among many observant Jews today, it was a shame and a dishonor to be single and childless. So it was like, he really stuck out like a sore thumb.
Sure.
And we did kind of say it at the time that maybe this was his beard.
Right. Yeah.
Like
needed a reason.
Not needed to have a reason to, yeah, you know, be single.
Right.
Marriage and childbearing, of course, were expected, and celibacy was highly unusual, not only in Israel, but throughout the Near East. So Jeremiah's obedience to God's command would definitely attract attention. But I found this interesting. Biblical Hebrew does not even have a word for bachelor.
Really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
So he definitely was like, what even do we call you?
Right. He was way outside the norm.
Yeah.
Wow. Sorry. If anybody heard that, that was our kitchen throwing shit on the ground.
I just assumed you were going to edit that out.
No. No.
Oh, okay. Okay. All right. Well, then verses 5-7, Jeremiah was commanded not to mourn with others.
Okay.
Okay. So verse 6 reads, both the great and the small shall die in this land. They shall not be buried, neither shall men lament for them, cut themselves, nor make themselves bald for them. Okay. So there's a lot going on in that verse.
Yeah.
In this verse, like, we missed this the first time through. He wasn't just instructed not to mourn. He's being instructed not to attend any of the funerals. So he can't even go to the funeral and then not mourn at the funeral.
Okay.
He's got to stay away from them completely.
Right.
And this is done as a warning that when Judah falls, there will be no funerals since the dead will lie unburied.
Well, because it's going to be war. He's sending people after them to kill them all.
Yeah.
And
the bodies will be left hither and yon.
Right. And that's what happens in wartime because, you know, obviously the people killing them, unless they're going to stay there and live there,
right,
don't care about cleaning them up, and they're not going to let the people back to get them.
Exactly.
So.
Exactly. So, but he's telling him, you know, you not attending funerals now is one of the signs these people should look at.
I have this feeling that the people that he didn't attend the funerals for were like, man, thank God
fucking right?
Jeremiah's not here. Jeez.
I know.
Fucking, guy's a weirdo, man.
What a naysaying butt. So breaking bread in time of mourning was one of the culturally accepted mourning practices, whereas the act of cutting themselves while in mourning was one of the many disobedient imitations of pagan rituals for the dead, which they had adopted.
Huh.
Because, again, there was a lot going on in that verse. One of the things was that they're not going to be buried and they shouldn't, you know, celebrate all of that, and they should not make themselves bald for them or cut themselves.
Right.
Okay. So these were rites of self-mutilation in which the mourners cut or gashed themselves and shaved the head and the beard, and they seem to have been widely practiced even though they were forbidden in those areas.
Well, we've talked about that too, but like, I mean, there there was a lot of things that they refused to let go from older practices. And I don't know that they were even older practices. I feel like this was all just kind of things that the Israelites did back then. And there was this other group of people like Jeremiah who was like, no, all those things need to go away. And they're like, but why?
Yeah. Like, you're weird. Stop telling us what to do, weirdo.
Right.
Yeah. And then in verses 8 and 9, that's where Jeremiah is commanded not to feast with them. And that goes back to the breaking bread with the mourning was a thing that they did.
Right, right.
So, okay, so that was the first part of chapter 16. Moving on.
Okay.
The next bit is verses 10 through 13, which God's judgment is explained to the people of Judah.
Okay. Yeah.
So in verse 11, it says, then you shall say to them, because your fathers have forsaken me, says the Lord, ...
Yeah.
Okay. So the coming conquest and exile of Judah was not due to the sin of only one generation. So where it says your fathers have forsaken me, it wasn't just because them old guys way back when were doing
bad the wrong things, right? It's been a succession of wrong things since then.
It was due to hardened rebellion over several generations that brought Judah to their soon to come judgment.
I see.
So God saying that was, you know, I've been looking away from this long enough and, you know, payment is due.
I guess. And, you know, I know we're going back to a lot of stuff that we read back in Kings and Chronicles and all that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. But back then it seemed like one king we were good, one king we were bad. One king we were good, one king we were bad, right?
Yes.
And it was always dependent on the king.
Right.
It wasn't dependent on the people.
Which we said during this last week as well when we talked about this.
Yeah. And all of a sudden we're just blaming them for all of it.
Yeah.
Like, oh, you were all bad.
Yeah. Instead of just the leaders.
Right.
It's all the people.
Yeah.
So verses 14 and 15 were about the wonderful promise of restoration from exile. Because, you know, God's always wishy-washy. And he's like, I'm going to get you.
Yeah.
And then he's like, but I'll let a few of you survive. It'll be fine.
Yeah. Right.
And then verses 16 through 18 are about the zeal of God in pursuing the people ripe for judgment.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
So he's trying to get them ready to go, right?
Sure.
So verse 16 says, behold, I will send for many fishermen, says the Lord, and they shall fish them. And afterward, I will send for many hunters, and they shall hunt them.
I'm assuming that this is meaning that he's going to send people to collect the people that have been enslaved and captured. Yes,
but there's a little bit more to it, okay?
Yeah.
Fishers were generally understood to be the Egyptians. So the Egyptians were going to come down and collect the people as they would when they were fishing. And then the hunters were considered the Chaldeans.
Okay.
So the Chaldeans are going to come in and pick up their... So they're going to be attacked from all sides.
Got it.
Is what we're getting here.
Okay.
All right. And, you know, then whoever is left is going to be taken away as slaves and assimilated into new cultures.
Sure. Okay.
Okay.
Yep.
And then verses 19 through 21 were about Yahweh being glorified among the Gentiles.
So, right, right.
And that was that whole chapter.
Okay.
Okay. So moving on to chapter 17. This chapter includes the third of the passages known as the Confessions of Jeremiah.
Okay.
Remember, we talked about earlier on, there were a couple examples where he was like lamenting.
Yeah.
Or being like, God, I can't handle this. Or why me?
Sure.
Or God, this sucks. So we're going to see that in this chapter.
Okay.
And for the third time. And there's a couple more coming up as well.
All right.
Because, you know, he's a whiny crybaby.
Yeah.
Okay, so in verses 1 through 4, we talk about paper and pen for Judah's sin. Now, before I talk about that exact thing, the paper and the pen, let's talk about how the fact that verses 1 through 4 are not actually in the Septuagint, the Greek version of this, Greek translation.
Okay.
So, like, one of the earliest versions of the Bible, verses 1 through 4, are not present.
So, this was added in.
This was added in.
Okay.
Correct.
Got it.
Okay?
Yeah.
So, what does verse 1 say? The sin of Judah is written with a pen of iron. With the point of a diamond, it is engraved on the tablet of their heart and on the horns of your altars.
Right.
Okay? And so... it's a weird thing to have, but it's also a weird thing to be missing once you know that some Bibles have it.
Yeah.
Right?
Right, right, right.
So a pen of iron was used for engraving by cutting inscriptions into rock or stone. So the point of the metaphor is not the hardness of the materials being used, but the indelible nature of what's being written.
Okay.
So it was just like this... imagery and symbolism of this thing is going to be engraved on you forever. You'll never be able to remove it.
Right,
so it wasn't about the tools so much as
how
the output.
It is.
Yes,
yeah,
exactly.
Right. Okay.
Okay. The image of, quote, sin written with an iron pen, this is really cool, is used by Israeli poets Devorah Amir, Dalia Falla, and Liat Kapp in criticizing Israel's occupation of lands conquered in the 1967 war and the resulting oppression of the Palestinian people, which I thought was very interesting because they were saying the sins of your crimes will be engraved on you with an iron pen.
Right. Right.
You know, for all eternity or what the fuck ever.
Yeah.
So they alluded to that and used it in their outcry against what was happening.
Yeah.
So I thought that was really cool.
I guess we could use it again today.
Yeah, we could. So. Today again to or still show. Or whatever.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Writing with the point of a diamond must refer to glass or some vitrified substance as it is distinguished here from engraving. And again, that just goes to show the
permanence
of the message.
Right.
Yeah. Or the permanence of the punishment. Like, you have sinned so greatly that it can never be removed. You're stained forever.
Right. Right.
So moving on to verses 5-8 are about the folly of trusting in man.
Okay.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And verse 6 reads, "For he shall be like a shrub in the desert." Do you remember that?
Kind of, yes.
Okay. So in Hebrew, the name of this tree is called the Arar, which sounds similar to the word for cursed, which is Aror.
Okay.
And I am sure that I'm not pronouncing those to the best of how they should be, but you can get the sense.
Pronunciation has never been our strong suit in
ever,
this podcast.
Ever. And you can get how they sound alike or how they're spelled alike at any rate. Mm-hmm. It's part of a wordplay that is central to this poem.
Got it.
Which, you know me, I'm always a sucker for some good wordplay.
Yeah.
So, you know, the tree, the type of tree sounds like the word cursed, and that's what, you know, God is telling Jeremiah is going to be.
Yeah.
Like.
Now, I feel like this is the kind of stuff, though, that you know, biblical people who are very, very much a believer in God and very versed in the Bible would say that, well, you just can't understand because, you know, there was things lost in translation and this was done this way versus that way. And I'm like, to some extent, I see your point, right?
Right.
But to some extent, I'm like, but the message is still the message. And we can dig into this as much as we want to. And we've done
some of that out.
We've done that research. And really, it doesn't change the messages dramatically.
Right.
It's just little quips about things that they wanted to emphasize or they wanted to, you know,
sure. Like,
it does make some difference in how it reads.
Sure.
But overall, the message is still the same message.
God is still a dick.
Right.
Like, yeah. You can phrase it differently, and you could take out maybe a couple of the times that we got it wrong and he wasn't actually a dick.
Well, you're not taking overall, out the message. You're taking out the poetry.
Right.
Right? You're exactly. Taking out the part that would have been, you know, clever or beautiful.
Yeah.
Right? That's the only thing that's missing. It's not the message. The message is still there, and we can still interpret the message the way it reads.
Which is that God is a dick.
Right. It might even be easier without the poetry because you don't get lost in that.
Right. Exactly. So. Yeah. Because I can go down the road forever with, like, symmetry and, you know, the poetics and the rhyme schemes, that kind of thing.
Right.
Like,
right.
Let's not.
Yeah.
So the Bedouin refer to this tree as the cursed lemon, or the Sodom apple, because it grows in the desert salt lands that surround the Dead Sea, where Sodom and Gomorrah once were.
Oh, gotcha.
So I looked up cursed lemon because I was like, that's cool. I want to know more. So there are musical bands named Cursed Lemon.
Oh.
There are all kinds of allusions to cursed lemon. So I wasn't the only one that read that and was like, that's badass. That's so cool. Like, there's a lot of stuff about it out there on the Googles. So moving on then, according to their legends, when God destroyed Sodom, this is the Bedouin legends.
Yeah.
He cursed the fruit of this tree so that the tree's fruit, when opened, makes a psst sound like air being released from a tire.
Okay.
And the fruit itself is said to be hollow and filled with webs, dust, and a dry pit.
Interesting.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So that would go towards the Sodom apples.
Got it. Yeah. Got it. Okay.
So that's cool.
Yeah.
Okay. So verses 9-10 were about the folly of trusting one's own heart.
Uh-huh.
You know, he talked about how, you know, you should trust God, not yourself.
Right. Right.
Okay. And then verse 11 was about the folly of trusting in riches. And verse 11 reads, "As a partridge that broods but does not hatch, so is he who gets riches but not by right. It will leave him in the midst of his days, and at the end he will be a fool."
Got
it. So we talked about this a little bit during the week, but I just wanted to hit it up again. Here Jeremiah states a proverb meant to show the foolishness of trusting in unearned riches. According to this ancient proverb, a partridge sits upon the eggs of other birds. When the eggs hatch, the chicks leave the partridge because they don't really belong to that bird. Likewise, Jeremiah claims that riches will leave a man when he stands before God in judgment.
Okay.
Okay?
Sure.
Like, whatever. But then I had to add my own little fun note, which I thought was funny and nobody else did. But I'm going to read it anyway. The moral of the story is don't count your chickens before they hatch and don't count on your chickens even after they hatch, especially if they aren't your chickens in the first fucking place. If you have chickens and you came by them fairly, wait till they are teenagers before you start counting on them. And really, if I'm being honest, you can never count on chickens regardless of how they come into your possession. So I just thought that cracked me up.
Yes. Yeah, I did.
You are being about noisy today. All right. So moving on. Verses 14 through 17 were about a prayer for deliverance and defense. And then verse 18 was a prayer for the justification of God's prophet. Who's Judd? I don't know. Anyway, a justification of God's prophet. And then Keep going. Run along through this, okay?
Okay.
Verses 19 through 23 were about Jeremiah delivering a message to the people, obey God's command of the Sabbath. Remember that bit?
Right, yeah. And he went on for a while about that.
It did, yeah. And then verses 24 through 27 were a promised blessing for obedience and curse for disobedience.
Sure.
Okay. And verse 24 read, and it shall be, if you heed me carefully, says the Lord, to bring no burden through the gates of this city on the Sabbath day, but hallow the Sabbath day to do no work in it. And then verse 25 continues, they and their princes, accompanied by the men of Judah and the inhabitants of Jerusalem, and this city shall remain forever. Okay.
Right. Yeah.
So we're going to talk about that a little bit.
Okay.
So Jeremiah spoke for the Lord and promised the people of Jerusalem and Judah that if they radically obeyed even just this one command, which we kind of talked about this.
We did, yeah.
We were like, so all they got to do is the one thing, right, obey the Sabbath and or respect the Sabbath and you'll be good, huh? So if they would just radically obey even this one command, God would preserve their city and their kingdom. It wasn't that the Sabbath was the only command important to God.
But he's just like, if you can just get one goddamn thing right.
Yeah, exactly. This offer to Jerusalem and Judah was simply a testing point. If they were willing to radically obey God on just this one fucking point, it would indicate a true repentance and submission to God that would extend to all the other points.
Okay.
So he was like, I'm going to grade you on a curve.
Right.
And they were like, meh. So this one point of obedience or disobedience would stand for all the others. This is like pass or fail, you know?
You know, if they had done it, we would have never heard about this.
Hypothetically, you know, like God would have moved the goalpost.
Right, like it wouldn't even been a, like this is just some prophet slash priest person sitting there going, I just need you to do this one thing for us and he'll forgive us all, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas there's other people out there still saying, you know, We're in good shape, right? Like, they're all saying these different things that are happening.
Yeah.
And this one guy's like, if you just do this one thing perfectly, then we'll be okay. But obviously, it didn't work out. They still got conquered. They still got captured. They still got killed.
Exactly.
So that's
God let it happen.
That's why we know about it. That's why it's a thing, because Jeremiah was like, if you just do this, and then according to him, they didn't. So now it's a bad thing, and it caused bad things, and now that's the lesson that we're supposed to take from this. But the bullshit of it is that if they had done it, we would have never even heard about it. And I said this earlier in this week, I think, at some point. Mm-hmm. The only reason we know about these things is because at some level, Jeremiah ended up being right. They got captured, killed, you know, enslaved, etc. Mm-hmm. And he was the one pitching these messages of doom and gloom. And so they're like, well, we probably should have listened to him, because if we just listened to him, we'd be okay.
Yeah.
But that's also bullshit.
Yeah. Well, that's what I'm saying.
The people were going to conquer him one way or the other. It
God would have moved the goalpost and there would have been a different reason.
Right. Yeah.
You know, well, I said that, but you didn't do it in your heart the right way and it wasn't enough. It was too late.
Yeah.
Or whatever.
It's bullshit.
Yeah. It is. What I found interesting was some of the notes compared this to how the obedience or disobedience for Adam in the Garden of Eden stood for all other sins. You know, do this one thing correctly.
Right.
And that, you know, is the end all be all of all time, punishment or living in the Garden of Eden.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
All right. So that was chapter 17.
Sure.
Moving on to chapter 18.
Okay.
Okay. This chapter includes the fourth of the passages known as the Confessions of Jeremiah.
All right.
Okay.
Yep.
So verses 1-4, Jeremiah visits the potter's house. Remember this?
Yes.
With the fucking clay?
Yeah, this was amusing to me.
Yeah, stupid to me. Verses 5-10 cover God's right to deal with his people as he pleases. And you and I discuss the morals of just because you can doesn't mean you should.
Right, right.
And then verse 6 reads, "O house of Israel, can I not do with you as this potter, says the Lord?" And then this has nothing to do with it, really. I just thought this was interesting. Note that God called the southern kingdom, which technically was not the kingdom of all 12 tribes, the house of Israel, because there were truly representatives from all 12 tribes among the people of Judah, from the migration of the godly, from the tribes of the northern kingdom of Israel to Judah in the days of Jeroboam.
Oh, so like when they were getting conquered up north, uh-huh. Some people moved down to Judah.
Yeah.
Which probably made them a stronger, that's probably why they lasted longer.
Yeah.
They're like, we got to get the fuck out of here. And they're going down to Judah. And Judah's like, oh shit, this shit's coming.
Yeah.
And so they were.
And that's how the politics of it, they could see what was coming down the road.
Right, right.
They knew.
And they were building their army because these people were escaping to them. Mm-hmm. So they had more people to, you know, bolster their numbers at that point, and which kept them safer for longer.
It did. And also, they were bringing their pagan practices with them.
Right,
and
right.
And so...
No, but the pagan practices were already there,
They too. Were already there.
It's yeah. just they, yeah. There was people bringing them and reinforcing some of that.
So. Exactly. So verse 11 was about devising a plan of judgment. Mm-hmm. And then verses 12 through 17 were about the response of the people and God's answer to them.
Okay.
Yep. So I'm going to read verses 13 and 14. "Therefore, thus says the Lord, ask now among the Gentiles, who has heard such things? The virgin of Israel has done a very horrible thing. Will a man leave the snow water of Lebanon, which comes from the rock of the field? Will the cold flowing waters be forsaken for strange waters?"
You said Lebanon? Was it Lebanon?
Yeah, it's Lebanon.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
I was like, Lebanon. What is Lebanon?
I've got a little bit of like a nasally thing going on. I apologize. So we asked about that at the time. We were like, what does that mean? And we decided that calling Israel a virgin, he's done that before.
Yeah.
And he's basically saying, you know, you've done this horrible thing. So now you're a whore.
Yeah.
And that the waters were about the clean waters versus the dry cistern.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, in turning from God to the idols, Judah and the people of Judah have done something that is almost unbelievable. Such action is as unnatural as that of a virgin who suddenly turns prostitute or of a snow-fed mountain stream that suddenly dries up.
Got it.
And those are two wonderful things that obviously compare to each other.
Yeah, in no way whatsoever.
Yeah, exactly. So verse 17 says, "I will scatter them as with an east wind before the enemy." And I found something that said the east wind is the sirocco, a hot, dry wind. I've heard that
before, actually.
It's a hot, dry wind coming from the eastern deserts.
Okay.
All right. So that's what he meant by that.
Yeah.
Them hot winds going to get you.
Right.
If I don't, the hot winds of sirocco will. Okay. So then the next section is verse 18, the plot against Jeremiah. We're getting in the thick of it now.
This is the personalized vendettas that he's got.
Yeah. So let me read that. "Then they said, come and let us devise plans against Jeremiah, for the law shall not perish from the priest, nor counsel from the wise, nor the word from the prophet." And okay. We skipped over that at the time because we were like really concentrating on how Jeremiah was like, they're plotting against me. They're plotting against me. This is unfair.
Right.
But it actually is worth looking at the priest, the wise, and the prophet.
Okay.
Like those are three separate things that three separate groups that are plotting against him.
Got it.
Okay. The law would be the priests.
Yeah.
You know, they're the religious people mm-hmm. and leaders of the church. And the council from the wise would be, you know, the elders, sure. the town elders.
Yeah.
And there are other prophets. In town.
Obviously they've alluded to yeah. them. So
all three of these very separate groups are combined together plotting against him.
Yeah.
So this is a very political thing, obviously.
Yeah, and he's very
Shitty.
Well, I mean, he's the minority here, right? Yeah. Like, he's definitely being ganged up on. He ended up in stockades at one point.
Yeah, so, we're going to talk about that.
Yeah.
That's interesting, too. I've got some notes about that.
Right.
So Jeremiah had been relentless in his condemnation of the three classes of officials referred to here. Priests, wise men, and prophets.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
It is probably safe to assume that it was these men of the establishment who instigated the plot, since they were the ones he specifically mentioned.
Sure.
So, I mean,
that's kind of what I was assuming when we were going through it, that it was important people that were.
Right. It's just we kind of skipped over who was plotting.
Sure.
The people are plotting.
Yeah.
The people in charge, those people.
Yeah.
But it was actually spelled out for us. So that's interesting, I think. So verses 19 and 20 were about Jeremiah pleading for himself, and then verses 21 through 23 were about Jeremiah pleading against his enemies.
Right.
God get him.
Yeah.
Okay. So that was Jeremiah chapter 18. Now we're moving into Jeremiah chapter 19.
Okay.
Okay. And shit's starting to get very real now.
Yeah.
Okay. This is about the broken vessel.
Okay. Yeah.
So verses 1 and 2 are about preparation for the message that's to come.
This is where he stood in front of all the people and shattered the
flask.
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
So verse 1 says, "Thus says the Lord, go and get a potter's earthen flask." Okay, so let's talk about that flask itself for a minute.
Uh-huh.
Okay. The earthen flask was probably a small clay bottle with a narrow neck. It was easily broken and could not be repaired in any way whatsoever. Like, once it was shattered, it was done.
Okay.
And that was the symbolism of that.
Got it.
The Hebrew noun bakbuk means clay jar, and it's an onomatopoeia. Are you familiar with that mean?
The same way forward as backward?
No.
Or what's the, no, I'm not sure.
No, onomatopoeia is a word that is the sound that it is.
Oh.
Like the word gurgle. Is an onomatopoeia, or like a susurration. The word itself is the sound.
Thing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. So the bakbuk
meow
sounds. Yeah. A meow. Exactly. The bakbuk, the clay jar, it sounds like the gurgling of outpouring water. Bakbuk, bakbuk.
Oh, okay.
So
right. Yeah.
I thought that was interesting.
Right.
Having come from the potter's house in the previous chapter, God showed Jeremiah how the potter could mold clay again into a new shape if it should seem resistant. But here, the clay is baked, hardened, and breakable. If there is nothing so workable as a clay pot in the making, there is nothing so unalterable as the finished product. If it's wrong by then, that's that. It's trash.
Oh, so this is a justification for him killing the Israelites.
Yes.
Like, you guys have been hardened. You cannot change, and now it's time to die.
Exactly. I thought that was a really clever comparison that we kind of missed.
We did. We did.
Yeah.
That's good symbolism.
Yeah. I in a writing sense, I appreciate it in the symbolism and the comparison.
Right. I still don't agree with the message.
No, at all.
But
the
symbolism is good.
It did kind of make me go, oh, that's actually kind of cool though.
Yeah.
Like writing is cool. Good writing, God. There you go.
Right.
Okay. Verse 2 reads, "And go to the valley of the son of Hinnom, which is by the entry of the potsherd gate."
Potsherd.
Okay. The potsherd gate likely corresponded to the dung gate. Do you remember that gate?
I remember it.
It was in Nehemiah. I kept calling it the poop gate.
Right.
Yeah. And it indicates that the valley was being used as a rubbish heap.
Mm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And it must have acquired its name from the fact that potters whose workshops were near the gate dumped their broken vessels beyond the gate. So that would be the potsherd gate.
Yeah. And dung gate, seems to indicate they dumped some shit out there too.
Right. That's where all of the animals' poop got scooped to, and probably the human poop as well.
Plumbing back then. So
they just piled it up at the gate.
Right.
That sounds yummy.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that happened. And then verse 3 was about the beginning of the message at the potsherd gate. Remember, he's standing there shouting shit.
Right.
Verses 4 through 5 is the reason for the catastrophe to come, which we already know is because God's mad and because the people suck or whatever.
Right, right.
And then verses 6 through 9 are about the description of the catastrophe to come. So before it was the reason, now it's the description.
Got
whatever.
It.
Who cares? Okay, so Verses 10 through 11 are about the breaking of the flask. So he throws it down and breaks it.
Yeah.
And then there's some who say that it's very likely that he emptied it out first because to make that sound, that bloop, bloop, bloop,
bloop. Yeah, you know, yeah. Okay.
To like symbolize, like, because it would have been a dramatic thing to do, to empty it and then break it.
I got it.
There's people who study the Bible and the phrasing and all that stuff and say
it's likely this is the way it went down.
Yeah, exactly. Okay. Which I'm like, I can appreciate that. Yeah.
Sure.
Okay. Sure. Okay. And then 12 through 13 is the meaning of the broken glass. And then 14 through 15 is after the message of the broken
glass. I have to wonder if they walked on the broken glass.
Walking on broken glass. Is that where you're going with that?
Yeah, that's where I was
going. Okay. Okay, Jeremiah chapter 20. We're about to wrap this shit up and bring it home.
Okay.
Okay.
Yep.
And this was kind of my favorite because the stockades.
Yeah, right.
Okay. And the smacking around. Jeremiah got
punished.
He got
smacked.
Okay. He got more than smacked. Okay. I'm going to tell you some shit here.
Okay.
And look, I'm no fan of Jeremiah, but he got
beat the fuck up.
He got beat the fuck up. Okay. It was not pretty.
Okay.
So this chapter includes the fifth of the passages known as the Confessions of Jeremiah.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
So he has been arguing with God a lot.
He has.
And I can see why after this chapter. Okay. So verses 1 through 2 are about Jeremiah being God's spokesman from the stocks.
Yeah.
Okay. So let me read verse 2. Then Pashur struck Jeremiah the prophet and put him in the stocks.
Yeah.
Okay, for one thing, that's the first time in Jeremiah that he's been referred to by title Jeremiah the prophet.
Right.
So we kind of missed that, but it was pointed out that, hey, just so you know, that's a thing. We did
point out that there was a narrator.
We did.
But we didn't pick up on that specific thing.
Yes, that's correct. But that was because what is about to happen to him is like so awful that respect of his name and title is being given to him, is being granted.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
So Pashur is the chief officer of the temple, and he was furious at Jeremiah's words. And so he arrested him, flogged him, and imprisoned him for the night. Okay. So Jeremiah was not just smacked, FYI. He was beaten quite badly. He was beat the fuck up. He got flogged.
Damn.
Yeah. That's what struck means. He got struck.
Okay.
And all right. So they flogged him, and it was likely about 40 times.
Damn.
Yeah. So that's what that meant.
Yeah.
And then
But you know, and look, as bad as that is, Jeremiah was saying
he was a rabble rouser.
Well, yeah. He was that, but he was also telling God that they wanted to kill him. They literally have him in their possession.
Yeah.
And they're not killing him. And look, again, what they did to him
was not fun.
Was not fun and not good, and I don't approve of it.
Right.
But he's telling God they want to kill him.
And then they let him go.
Right. So right. I just want to clarify that point because
no, that's fair.
He's telling God something that didn't actually happen, even though they had him.
But here's another argument against that. Maybe they were like, because remember, they let him go the next day, which I'm about to get into.
Okay.
Maybe they told him, we're going to let you go. This was just a taste of what's to come if you don't shut the fuck up and stop your shenanigans.
I guess that could be.
I imagine that's what it was.
Okay. All right.
And that's just me. Like, you don't just flog somebody 40 times and then lock them up in this device that I'm about to tell you about.
Yeah.
And then let him go the next day and then everything's all better.
But then the fucker walked out and he started talking shit again.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm just, you know.
Yeah.
Whatever.
He did. Okay. So let's talk about the stocks.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay.
The stocks were a form of scaffold in which prisoners were detained in a crooked or confined position, which produced muscle cramps.
Oh.
Okay. The Hebrew word is formed from the verb to twist, implying that this twist frame clamped the victim in a position that would become increasingly distressing. Their function was to inflict cruel and inhuman torture upon the hapless victim.
Oh.
So that's what I'm saying.
So this wasn't just like putting your head and arms through a board.
No, this was not like how you picture the stocks.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
He was flogged and then he was put into this torture device, and then the next morning let go. I'm positive that they must have told him, this was nothing.
Yeah.
We will fucking kill you.
Got it.
If you don't stop.
Okay.
In which case, that lends me to a little bit of, I can understand why he was questioning God. Like, Jesus Christ.
They're going
to
kill me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You have to stop. You have to stop making me do this. I can't. This is bad. This is not good. I cannot.
Sure. Sure.
I'm getting nothing good out of this.
Right.
So that does kind of change the story a little bit, right? Knowing all of this.
I guess.
Insofar as in canon.
Yeah. Okay. If we were to accept the fact, the hypothesis, the idea that God was literally talking to Jeremiah.
Sure. That first of all, there is a God.
Right.
And that God
was, this takes so many leaps of faith to get there if we accepted that, right?
Sure.
And then accepted the fact that apparently it was to such an extent that Jeremiah literally couldn't keep his mouth shut.
Yeah.
I guess then I can understand his point of view.
Yeah.
Right? But that just takes so many, ridiculous leaps of faith to get there. And that's not even for the entire book of the Bible. That is just for Jeremiah.
And just in this section.
Right.
Yeah.
So.
No, I'm with you. I'm just saying, I'm trying to accept this story, just the little pieces at a time.
Yeah.
And it does add a little bit of feeling to it.
Well, and I can see, this kind of, what we're just talking about right now, right?
Yeah.
You can point by point make a argument for God if you accept this, if you accept that, if you accept this, if you accept that, right? So you can talk away any particular point. But then when you talk about in general, how many things you have to accept or believe in order to get there.
Or overlook.
It's a substantial amount to just get to the point where you then can even fathom talking about the belief of an actual God.
Sure. I'm right there with you.
Right.
So I'm torn because I'm being pulled in several different directions. Okay. I'm reading the Bible for the first time as an agnostic turned hardcore atheist.
Sure.
Okay. And so that's where I'm right there with you. I'm also reading this as the person who's researching the history of it and filling in some blanks.
Right.
And so that's cool, right?
Yeah.
And then I'm also reading this as a writer who can appreciate a good story.
Right.
And so I'm having to juggle all of these different ways of viewing this story. And sometimes I walk away going, oh, that's cool. When what I really mean at the end of the day, regardless of how cool it is, but I still don't believe in God, and the God of the Bible is a fucking dick.
Well, and something we have lost we don't talk about this as much. Like when we first started Jeremiah, let's say at chapters 1 through 5, right?
Yeah.
We were talking about how it was much better written than Isaiah.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
The wording, the phrasing, everything about the poetry, everything was so much better than what Isaiah was.
Mm-hmm.
We've lost the ability to see that, I think. Because the message is so repetitive and
repellent. Whiny.
Yeah.
Yes.
And so we're losing some of the beauty that is there if you picked it out.
Sure.
In the message, because the message is just crap.
Yeah. I mean, a flaming pile of shit is still a pile of shit.
Yeah.
No matter how beautiful the flame, right? All right. So moving on, verses 3 through 6 are about Jeremiah's message to Pashur upon his release.
This is where he started talking shit immediately upon leaving the fucking stockade.
Yes, but there's more about that too.
Okay, sure.
So let me read verse 3. And it happened on the next day that Pashur brought Jeremiah out of the stocks. Then Jeremiah said to him, "The Lord has not called your name Pashur, but Magor-Missabib." And we were like,
"Yeah, well, who the fuck is that?"
Yeah. Okay, so let's talk about this scene.
Okay.
Okay.
Yeah.
And I've got a pretty good paragraph here to get through.
Okay.
Okay. So, Pashur was the priest and chief governor, and he likely thought that letting him go the next day was a kind and humanitarian act.
Sure.
I've let you go.
Right.
I didn't keep you there all day. I merely flogged you 39 or 40 times and then locked you in a torture device, but I did let you go.
We taught you a lesson.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
He didn't want to be overly cruel to Jeremiah the cuckoo bean.
Sure.
And he thought that Jeremiah had likely learned his lesson, like you said.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah.
The meaning of the name Pashur is freedom ease, peacefulness, tranquility. Hmm. On the other hand, the name Magor-Missabib is the exact opposite. It translates to mean terror on every side.
Hmm.
So that to us sounds like no big deal. But what he is saying is, you know better, motherfucker.
Yeah.
And God's not going to call you peace and tranquility.
Oh.
You will be among the harshest punished, and it will come from all sides, and you should be very fucking afraid.
You know how names have meanings, right? Like, if you look them up, do you think people back then knew what their like? I don't know offhand what the meaning of my name is, or your name, or our kid's name, or anything.
Right.
I could look it up, and I could find some information on it. Right.
Mm-hmm.
But do you think people walked around back in ancient days knowing what their name meant?
Well, this guy knew what he was saying.
Okay. All right.
He was saying, that's why God's going to call you this instead of that.
Right. No, obviously, you know? That's why I'm asking the question. Maybe it was a lot more common to know the meaning behind names back then than it is now.
Well, maybe that wasn't a name. Maybe that was the words terror on all sides.
All right. That could be too.
So, yeah.
Right.
At any rate, he was making a statement.
Sure. Okay.
So that makes that make a little bit more sense, which I appreciate.
Yeah, I didn't understand what that meant at the time.
So here's where I get into a little bit of paragraph reading. Okay. Mm-hmm. This was so interesting to me. I couldn't wait to get to this part.
Got it.
The man was of high authority, the deputy high priest, in fact, an office that made him second only to the governor of the temple.
Okay.
Okay. So he was not just like
nobody,
a priest or like a security guard or something. Right. Okay. Yeah. He was like right at the top.
Sure.
Okay. He had falsely assumed the prophetic office. He was not supposed to be prophesizing, much less falsely prophesizing. His position did not allow for him to be one who prophesies.
Okay.
But he was out there being one of the one of the prophets saying, nah, don't worry. Jeremiah's got this crazy. I talk to God all the fucking time. God says it's going to be fine.
Okay.
Chillax. Right. And we are going to hear from this Pashur guy in coming chapters.
You say we are?
We are.
Okay.
Yeah. Right. So, I'm excited to hear how his story goes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
But anyway, he was giving prophecies, and he was not supposed to be doing that from his position. That was not his job.
But isn't a prophet just somebody that God speaks to? Like, how do you determine, what is your position to deem whether or not you can be a prophet or not?
Only specific people within the church. Like, he was more in the legalic side, the legalese.
Okay.
And he was not supposed to be, it just wasn't something
but that was Jeremiah in a position to
do that? Well, his family was one of the wealthy families that were likely the ones that held the Ark of the Covenant at one time. And so, yeah, he has a background in being closely tied to this God.
Okay. So it just seems like an awfully convenient excuse. So to where Jeremiah can prophesy and then this guy can't. That's all.
I don't disagree, but let us not forget that there's a lot of politics going on, which I'm about to get into.
Right, right.
Okay.
Which is why I'm questioning whether Jeremiah technically was somebody who was allowed to prophesy.
Well, we know he came from a wealthy family, and we know that his family was closely tied to what would have been the Levites and likely was the place where the Ark of the Covenant was being cared for at one time.
Right.
So even if he wasn't specifically called to be a prophet, everybody would have believed, yeah, that tracks.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Well, yeah. I mean, anybody from
that didn't seem to like him that much. So that's why I'm saying.
Right.
You know, then
the prophecies that he was giving were against what everybody else had agreed to prophesy.
Got it.
Okay.
Yeah.
So that's why they didn't like him. It had nothing to do with where he came from.
Okay.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And again, I'm going to get into that a little bit here.
Sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
So Pashur was not supposed to be prophesizing. Okay. Most probably, he and his friends formed a political party in Jerusalem, clamoring for an alliance with Egypt, because there were some people doing that at the time.
Which would kind of make some sense, because it's obvious that they know they're going to be getting invaded.
Yes, so. Because they've already had refugees coming down,
right,
telling them about the storm that was brewing and coming their direction.
Yeah.
Yes. So These guys probably believed that such an alliance with Egypt would provide the security that Israel so desperately needed at that time. Jeremiah's stern prophecies were a threat to Pashur's position.
Got it.
And the drastic action against Jeremiah was designed to support Pashur's evil policy, which, of course, he backed up with false prophecies, an act that was he was not authorized to perform in the first place.
Got it.
So there was so much politics going on.
Yeah.
Right. That him letting him go was supposed to be a show of power.
Okay.
Like, I have magnanimously released you from the stockade.
Sure.
The torture device.
Yep.
And Jeremiah came out not thankful, but pissed. Like, I'm pissed at God because they're trying to kill me and you're making me do this. And this is bullshit.
Right.
And then he's telling Pashur, you know, don't do me any fucking favors.
Right.
You know, it's coming for you regardless.
Yeah.
And, you know, now you're getting it worse than you already were, because now you are 100% actively involved in trying to shut down what I'm saying.
Right.
And everything about you is wrong.
Right, right.
So I could understand now why he's so fucking wishy-washy and, like, he's like, save the people. God, I hate these people. Save the people. Ugh, these guys. You know? Save the people, except for those bastards.
I guess. Yeah, I mean, like, a lot of the things, it doesn't change my opinion on what I've said about how God is treating them as a whole or anything like
sure.
that. And really, it doesn't change my opinion about Jeremiah. I still think he was a whiny asshole.
Oh, definitely. You know, it doesn't make me think he was any less whiny. It just makes me sympathetic maybe to why he was whiny.
Okay.
Because right. I don't know that I would have been any better in his position. And that's what I'm trying to imagine.
But again, coming from the standpoint of God is literally speaking to you.
Right.
Which I don't accept.
So. No, totally. I still think that he was a cuckoo bean.
Yeah.
But reading this part, let me just view it as a story.
Sure.
You know, yeah. And how are the characters moving and character motivation and all that.
Yeah.
The writer in me was really appreciating all of this part.
Right.
Okay. So moving on, verses 7-8 were about Jeremiah speaking to God of his own faithlessness. So in verse 7, he says, Lord, you induced me and I was persuaded. And remember, I took offense to the word induce.
Yes.
Fuck off. Okay, so Jeremiah seems to be saying that he had understood his relationship to Yahweh to be something like a marriage bond, but now he's claiming that he had been deceived, enticed, or seduced by Yahweh, who had used him and tossed him aside.
Ah.
Because he's like, I just got beat the fuck up, put in a torture device.
Right.
And they are threatening to kill me. This is bullshit. I didn't sign up for this.
Why didn't you stop him?
Yeah. Like, how am I supposed to keep believing that you got me?
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
And it was the torture he endured in the stocks that drew from Jeremiah this last outburst toward God.
Okay.
Okay?
Yeah.
So then in verses 9-10, Jeremiah resolves to stop his prophetic work. But then in verses 11-12, he talks about his confidence in God, which is great. But then, you know, in verse 13, he praises mighty God, but then we get to verses 14-18 to finish out the chapter and grief and depression strike again.
Right.
It's like he talks himself up and he's like, okay, God is great,
I'm
good.
I'm gonna do this, yeah.
But then he's like, but God damn, my arms hurt, all my legs hurt, my body, God, this hurts, this is stupid, what am I doing?
Yeah, and so, I gotta be honest, you know, if I was having this personal talking relationship with God.
Yeah.
I'd be like, why didn't you stop this shit? Why didn't right. you kill Pashur? Why didn't you make him be captured? Why didn't you do something to make this not happen?
Yeah. And it kind of makes sense why he would be like, if you're going to kill all these fucks, make sure he's top of the list. Would you?
Right. No, and again, in canon. I can
story understand world.
That.
Yeah.
So.
All right. So let's finish this up. Okay.
Yep.
Verse 17 says, because he did not kill me from the womb, that my mother might have been my grave and her womb always enlarged with me. Why did I come forth from the womb to see her labor and sorrow, that my day should be consumed with shame? Remember, he's like, why was I ever born? This sucks.
Right.
And we're like, what the fuck is that about?
Yeah.
Why are you and Job always being like,
we can never be born? Yeah, right.
Yeah. This one actually has a specific reason.
Okay.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Jeremiah traces his troubles back to the womb because God told him in verse 1 of the book of Jeremiah that God had called him before he was born.
Yeah.
Jeremiah thought his problems would be over if he had never been born, right? So let's just read verse 1 of chapter 1 of
Jeremiah. I remember
Jeremiah. It was really weird. I kind of forgot. I kind of forgot. So, and I'm sorry, it wasn't verse 1. It was verses 4 and 5 of chapter 1.
Okay.
Okay. Then the word of the Lord came to me saying, before I formed you in the womb, I knew you. Before you were born, I sanctify you. I ordained you a prophet to the nations. And that, remember, he was like born circumcised or whatever.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But because he actually told those specific words to Jeremiah, that's Jeremiah not blaming his mother and saying, when did I have to be born and fuck my mother anyways?
Right.
That's him saying like, you know, you called me from the womb. Why? This sucks. This is stupid.
Yeah.
Like, I wish you hadn't. If I'd never been born, then you couldn't have called me from the fucking womb.
So Jeremiah is a reluctant prophet then?
Oh, he's not just reluctant. He's like, this is bullshit.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny.
It is kind of funny. So that's the end of my travels through the last 5 chapters.
Yeah.
And I'm really glad that I got to revisit things with a little bit more of a pointed eye than picking out one question to answer and going down a rabbit hole that way.
Yeah. Yeah.
This really made the story make a lot more sense. And I might be doing it this style, like recapping the chapters for the rest of Jeremiah, because I feel like we might have missed some important stuff earlier on.
Yeah.
And I have found a couple of more sources that really lend a lot of input into all these stories.
Sure.
So
that's kind of, you and I had talked about this.
Yeah.
But I kind of asked you to step back and stop given as much during each chapter.
Yeah.
Because I felt like it was not
helpful in the moment.
Yeah. Like these things that we get to go back at the end of the week and kind of look back.
Yeah.
We have a larger perspective of what we're talking about, and it gives you a little bit more time to investigate things that you find interesting.
Yeah.
And so I like those a little bit better than in the moments. Now that's not
I appreciate
to say,
the recap too, though. The recap with the added notes to me makes the story make more sense.
Sure. Yeah.
For and sure. I'm a person that requires repetition. I don't remember shit.
Right.
So, yeah.
All right. Well, that was our Q&A for today.
Yes.
All right. Which means that we will be back tomorrow on Sunday with our
Patreon.
And then I will get out the weekly wrap up and we'll be back on Monday with
Jeremiah chapter 21.
All right. We'll see you guys then.
Bye.
Hey, wife, I guess that's the end?
But husband, that's just sad.
It doesn't have to be. We are on lots of social media platforms like Twitter. Our handle there is sacrilegious_D.
For D's nuts.
Oh my God. Stop doing that. Anyway, we're also on Facebook, Instagram, and Pinterest. There's a link to all of our social media sites at our website.
Ooh, we have a website?
Yeah, it's sacrilegiousdiscourse.com, where you can also find a link to our merch shop.
We have a merch shop?
Yep. We have podcast-themed clothing, mugs, notebooks, and more, as well as an atheist and science-themed products.
Wow, our fans should really go check that out right now.
Definitely. They can get in touch with us by sending an email to sacrilegiousdiscourse@gmail.com. But before they do that, we could really use some help.
Oh yeah? With what?
Well, it's not free running the podcast, and we need some financial support in order to get better equipment, which will free up time so we can concentrate on our podcast and our fans.
Okay, so what should they do?
Head over to patreon.com/sacrilegiousdiscourse and sign up as a contributor on our podcast. Supporters there receive additional bi-weekly episodes that we record just for our Patreon members for as little as $2 a month.
Also, we'd really appreciate it if you would like and subscribe on whatever platform you're using.
And Apple Podcast reviews help us out tremendously.
Like and subscribe. Leave an Apple review. Join us on Twitter. Support us on Patreon. That's a lot of instructions. Don't forget to say thanks.
Thanks.
Okay, bye.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things.
Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.